United Nations raises alarm over Russian attacks on vital humanitarian aid in Ukraine.
There is no excuse for attacking the most vulnerable or the brave humanitarian workers who are supporting them.
Plus, the United States says Russia may be turning to Iran to resupply its depleted drone arsenal.
This is about a burgeoning defense relationship that is inherently making it easier for Mr. Putin to kill Ukrainians.
And remembering a VOA broadcaster who helped carve a path for American jazz worldwide. Today is Tuesday, May 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. Ukrainian air defenses thwarted an intense Russian attack in Kyiv early Tuesday, shooting down all 18 missiles aimed at the capital. As European officials met in Iceland in a rare summit of the 46-nation Council of Europe, which again vowed support for member state Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports the goal of the meeting is to find concrete ways for Russia to be held accountable for the damage it has inflicted on its neighbor.
The two-day summit of Europe's main human rights body will focus on providing legal and judicial means to go after the Kremlin. By Wednesday's conclusion, leaders at the summit want to have the outlines of a system in place to set up a register of all the damage already caused by Russian forces so Moscow can be held liable for compensation to the victims later. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The United Nations Security Council also met Tuesday in Geneva, where UN Undersecretary General Martin Griffiths described the disastrous humanitarian toll Russia's war is taking on the lives of Ukrainians.
Only last week in Kherson, residential buildings only last week, a school, an outpatient hospital, an elderly care facility were reportedly damaged, leaving scores of civilians needing shelter and health care. And missile strikes in Odessa hit a humanitarian storage warehouse. A Ukrainian Red Cross mobile hospital in Mykolaiv was also hit. Humanitarian supplies and vital medical equipment were destroyed.
And here's permanent representative of the United Kingdom to the UN, Barbara Woodward.
The UK is appalled by reports of recent Russian attacks on the Ukrainian Red Cross warehouses in Odessa and on a mobile hospital in Mykolaiv. There is no excuse for attacking the most vulnerable or the brave humanitarian workers who are supporting them.
Meanwhile, the White House says Russia is looking to get more advanced firepower from Iran for use in Ukraine.
This is about a burgeoning defense relationship that is inherently making it easier for Mr. Putin to kill Ukrainians. And Iran is directly involved in that killing.
U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby speaking with reporters at a news conference on Tuesday. U.S. President Joe Biden and top congressional leaders met for a second time on Tuesday at the White House in a new effort to reach an agreement to raise the country's debt ceiling and avoid defaulting. The White House also announced that Biden is scaling back an overseas trip as the issue remains unresolved. But as VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington reports, the president is still planning to attend this week's Group of Seven Leaders Summit in Hiroshima, Japan.
The White House says the president will return home Sunday after the G7 meeting concludes so he can hold further meetings with congressional leaders to avert an economically disastrous default by the U.S. government not paying its bills. Biden met Tuesday with top lawmakers. There was progress, according to the participants, but no agreement on raising the debt ceiling. That compelled the White House to cut from the travel agenda. An unprecedented presidential visit to Papua New Guinea to meet with Pacific Island leaders, as well as a stop in Australia, where Biden was to address a joint session of Parliament. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
The United States says it's committed to working to support peace between Israel and the Palestinians following intense fighting in recent days between the two sides. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Israeli-Palestinian Affairs Andrew Miller, in an interview with Al-Hurra TV, said the U.S. is in contact with the parties seeking to mediate a ceasefire in Israel and Gaza.
We are going to continue to work with Israelis and Palestinians in concert with our partners to promote calm in the weeks and months ahead, but also to advance measures that improve the livelihoods of the Palestinian people, the security of the Israeli people, and also preserve the two-state solution.
And I spoke with Elisheva Goldberg, Senior Director of Media and Policy with the New Israel Fund, to discuss the latest barrage of Gaza rocket attacks and Israel's high-powered response, starting with the question of whether this latest round of fighting is different.
The politics of the moment are different, but the deaths and destruction are the same. You know, this has been a series. Almost every year, there's been an operation in Gaza, which means that there are rockets that come, they hit Israeli territory, they destroy buildings, sometimes they kill people. In this case, one life was taken. And the Israeli military then responds with, you know, a lot of bombing, and in this case, targeted killing. This one started because of the death of a man named Khadr Adnan, who was affiliated with Islamic Jihad. He was a hunger striker who had been striking for a very long time in protest of being detained without trial, which he had been on and off for many, many years. And he died in an Israeli prison. And as a result, Islamic Jihad, with which he's affiliated, launched rockets at Israel, and Israel responded with its own bombardment. And then there was a second round. And it's hard to tell, it's hard to parse why. You know, we don't have the military intelligence, but there's also a world of politics that stands behind all of these military incursions. And it's certainly speculative to say that this was good for Netanyahu, although anytime a prime minister is seen as attacking the enemy of his country, which certainly is Hamas and certainly is Islamic Jihad, his popularity rises. But, you know, it certainly does also draw attention away from the other major thing happening in Israel right now, which is these massive pro-democracy protests that are trying to prevent the government from undermining and completely tearing apart the checks and balances between the judiciary and the legislature. So in some sense, you know, it also does that for Netanyahu. It pulls the attention away. The only week that the Israeli protests, these mass protests that have been happening every single week, did not happen was last Saturday night. They didn't happen because the protest organizers decided it was too dangerous. There were, you know, red alerts and there could have been rockets and they didn't want to endanger the lives of the protesters. It's certainly a shift in the way things have been going.
But it happened organically. It's not that Israel's harsh response was in some way political to sort of get the heat off of Netanyahu?
Right. Great question. There's always a political element. And I do think it's really hard to tell. But, you know, the one thing that we did see was Itamar Ben-Gvir, which is Netanyahu's far-right, racist, homophobic flank that he has brought into his government. Basically, since the beginning of this Knesset session, which was April 30th, he was boycotting all of the parliamentary and governmental duties that he had and that his party had. He wasn't showing up for votes. He wasn't going to committees. He just wasn't participating in the government. And he was saying it was because the government had not responded with strong enough force against Islamic Jihad when they had launched rockets. And, you know, when Netanyahu did go in and did bomb them and did have a show of force and many innocent people died and families were ruined, he celebrated and he said, this was because of me. Now, that's a political statement. And he tried to turn this into a political event in that way. But it is arguable, and analysts have debated this, whether or not actually Netanyahu had wanted anything to do with his agenda. And in fact, this seemed to have been something that was planned in advance. But, you know, ultimately, what it comes down to is that this happens over and over and over again, and there isn't actually a vision. So part of what we're struggling with in this question is that this is conflict management. This is an attempt to kill, you know, the same leaders of Islamic Jihad that Israel killed last time. They're the same positions. We're talking about, you know, just a kind of cycle where there is no end in sight. And the vision of the right-wing government has consistently been just maintain this cycle, maintain the killing and the destruction and the killing and the destruction, and somehow hope that that will bring security. But we know that there is no security in constant battle and in constant fighting and in the destruction of lives and property.
Elisheva Goldberg, Senior Director of Media and Policy with the New Israel Fund. We are following these other stories from around the world. Human rights defenders have sharply criticized Pakistan for announcing plans to use military laws to prosecute those responsible for arson during recent protests sparked by the arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. Amnesty International described the controversial move as alarming and contrary to international law and demanded it be struck down immediately. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society said Tuesday a badly needed batch of humanitarian supplies reached Port Sudan as more violence was reported amid the conflict between Sudan's army and a rival paramilitary group. And UN agencies describe an unfolding humanitarian catastrophe in the aftermath of Cyclone Moka, which hit Myanmar's Rakhine State with brutal force on Sunday. More than 1 million people in this region, mainly Rohingya Muslims, already are displaced by conflict in the region. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
There is an interplanetary competition between Saturn and Jupiter that has been going on for years. The race is based on how many moons have been discovered circling each planet. Scientists, for example, would find new moons orbiting Jupiter that would push the planet into the contest lead, and then new satellites would be found around Saturn and it would become the front runner. Back and forth it went between the solar system's two biggest planets. Back in February, astronomers discovered 12 new moons around Jupiter, allowing it to take the lead from Saturn. Recently, astronomers led by Edward Ashton of Taiwan's Academia Sinica Institute of Astronomy and Astrophysics and formerly of the University of British Columbia have discovered 60 new moons circling Saturn. So, the ringed planet is now ahead with 145 moons to Jupiter's 92-moon collection. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. The Supreme Court of Namibia has ruled in favor of recognizing same-sex marriages from other countries, making Namibia only the second nation on the continent to do so after South Africa. Vitalio Angula reports from Windhoek, Namibia.
A small group of LGBTQ activists gathered at Namibia's Supreme Court Tuesday, where justices ruled in a 4-1 vote that Namibians married to foreign nationals in foreign jurisdictions must be recognized as any other couple within the country. One of the judges, J.A. Mainga, dissented on the basis that the laws of Namibia do not recognize same-sex relationships. The other four judges, however, ruled that not recognizing same-sex couples infringes on their rights to dignity and equality. VOA spoke to the legal counsel of the same-sex couples, Carly Schrickeling, who appealed an earlier judgment of the High Court of Namibia not to recognize their same-sex marriages.
Today, after a six-year battle, we finally won, and the court has ruled that the Ministry of Home Affairs has to recognize these marriages by foreign spouses to Namibian spouses.
Over the past few months, the Supreme Court of Namibia has been hearing similar cases that deal with the subject of homosexuality. In one case, a Namibian citizen, Friedel Dausab, is asking for the repeal of an anti-sodomy law. In another case, which was dismissed in March, a Mexican national and his Namibian partner asked the top court to grant Namibian citizenship to their child, conceived through surrogacy in South Africa. The Mexican national in that case, Guillermo Delgado, spoke to VOA outside the Supreme Court on Tuesday.
Our case is very similar, and this represents a direct victory also for us. It's recognition that of our marriage and our dependence.
Linda Baumann of the Diverse Women's Organization said this judgment will help homosexual couples get access to the same services as heterosexual couples. Hypothetically speaking, she said, as a lesbian woman, she could bequeath her estate to her lesbian partner when she dies, or she might be able to buy a house together with a same-sex spouse if the court gave rights to same-sex couples in all spheres of society. She cautioned that this is just a ruling.
It's important to understand firstly the case, the status of this case. It's couples that are coming back to this country to claim their right to equality, their right to dignity, the right to family. But to answer that question on same-sex marriages, I believe that a lot of LGBT people in this country, we experience a number of inequalities in service, in benefits, in having the right to say something over your partner.
While over 30 African countries have laws prohibiting same-sex relationships, Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa have taken a different stance. Many gay Namibian couples now get married in South Africa. And after Tuesday's ruling, activists are asking whether gay couples should have the right to get married in Namibia as well. Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says America's leading cause of overdose deaths is synthetic opioids, mostly fentanyl, which can be up to 50 times stronger than heroin. VOA's Natasha Mozgovaya looks at community efforts to tackle the challenges of fentanyl abuse and homelessness in part three of this five-part series.
Kent Hay has been coming to this encampment on the Green River outside Seattle for more than 2 years, trying to persuade people here to get addiction treatment and move to shelter.
If we can get you approved, they're going to fund it starting in April.
Okay, so I need to get this done.
Yeah.
All right.
Fentanyl abuse is common here, where the smell of burning pills mixes with the aroma of campfire smoke.
It's rare that I come across a person who's not using, you know, fentanyl. And so it's hard to get those people to participate in treatment.
Addressing the combined challenges of fentanyl addiction and homelessness can be politically polarizing. King County Council member Sarah Perry says the solution requires response on multiple levels, including community involvement.
There are people. They come from our zip codes. They stay in our zip codes. These are our kids and our parents and our siblings and our cousins. They can't just go away somewhere. We have to own this together and do the right thing so everyone has a safe place to live and everybody feels safe walking around.
Letting drug addicts decide when they're ready for treatment is inhumane, says former county council member Kathy Lambert. She wants mandatory inpatient rehabilitation.
They need a place where they are essentially forced to use the time to get their bodies cleaned up so that they can make good decisions. And like anybody else, if you walked along the street and you saw somebody having an appendicitis attack, you don't say to them, I'll take care of you when you're ready. You immediately scoop them up and get them services. That's what's needed here.
At the University of Washington Center for Community-Engaged Drug Education, Epidemiology and Research, Caleb Banta-Green says improving social and medical services is more effective and less damaging than mandatory treatment.
Before we start trying to force people to treatment, what I would argue is, why don't we make far better treatment services that people actually want? Because when we do, they line up for it.
In the meantime, outreach workers like Hay continue to meet fentanyl addicts where they are and try to get them help. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Auburn, Washington.
May 17th marks the anniversary of the death of Willis Conover, the Voice of America broadcaster who helped popularize American jazz worldwide. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan looks back on his career and global impact on music and diplomacy.
Willis Conover speaking. This is the Voice of America Jazz Hour.
Between 1955 and 1996, Conover had one of the world's most familiar and distinctive voices, as tens of millions tuned in for his weekly Jazz Hour. Through the dark days of the Cold War, the U.S. government embraced jazz as a way to promote American values, and Conover helped create worldwide interest in the music.
He believed that jazz was an art form for everyone, but he also saw it as being something that was democratic, something where the strength came from a willingness to listen, a willingness to improvise, and he found those same qualities in the democratic system in the United States.
He was close to the greats of the jazz world, musicians like Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Sarah Vaughan. Black musicians were immensely popular, but faced widespread prejudice.
He broke those barriers, especially in Washington, D.C., by producing concerts intentionally, blending people with different ethnic backgrounds into groups to perform in the clubs in D.C.
Conover built bridges, whether touring Eastern Europe or broadcasting from his studio.
Let's hear another example of jazz from Hungary.
He once did a special program just for jazz fans in India. U.S. officials sponsored overseas tours by jazz musicians, and Conover, an international star, sometimes accompanied them. He introduced musicians to new styles and audiences to talents like South Africa's Miriam Makeba.
It's always been a music that interacted with adjacent styles. So it's just evolving with as it continues to interact with what's out there.
Conover promoted this cross-pollination and left a major legacy in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe.
People talk about him in Cuba. He's well remembered in Russia. And I think it's a part of his fate is to be forgotten in his own country, but still beloved internationally.
Conover also left his mark on generations of musicians in all parts of the world. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the earliest casualties of Russia's senseless war in Ukraine, and one of the globally most devastating, was the stoppage of food shipments from Ukraine, the world's fifth largest exporter of wheat and the second largest exporter of sunflower oil, as drought and strife caused unprecedented food insecurity in vulnerable regions around the world. Russia's blockade of Ukrainian ports decimated supplies of food available to aid organizations. With the July 27, 2020 signing of the Black Sea Grain Initiative, brokered by Turkey and the United Nations, exports of Ukrainian grain resumed. But the initiative expires on May 18th, giving Russia the opportunity to again block the passage of cargo ships to and from Ukraine's ports, even before the original agreement expires, and to threaten to pull out of the Black Sea Grain Initiative altogether. We should not need to remind Moscow every few weeks to keep their promises and to stop using people's hunger as a weapon in their war against Ukraine, said United States Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Speaking at a Foreign Press Center briefing on the Black Sea Grain Initiative, Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield said that with over 345 million people facing high levels of food insecurity right now, we are facing a global food crisis. This is a crisis felt most acutely in Africa and the Middle East, and especially by people in countries where food was already in short supply, she said. The point of the Black Sea Grain Initiative is to make sure grain and food supplies get to those in desperate need and to stabilize global markets. The initiative has enabled the export of over 30 million metric tons of foodstuff. Most of it went to various aid organizations, which then delivered desperately needed supplies to those most in need. For example, Ukrainian food fueled the World Food Program's humanitarian operations in Afghanistan, Somalia, and Yemen, saving countless lives. The world needs the Black Sea Grain Initiative, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. What's more, the world needs Russia to end its illegal war against Ukraine, which would allow farmers to return to their fields, return agricultural trade to normal and immediately and significantly improve global food security. In the meantime, Russia must stop playing games with the lives of hungry people around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.